internet, humans only live to 50? What's the point of even being born? My name is Matthew Kroll.
And kill one guy, one stupid guy who no one loves. My name is Shahir Dowd.
And this is the only podcast about movies, specifically the film Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 3.
Have you got the mixtape? Did I make you a mixtape? Should
you
we make each other mixtapes?
We want to make mixtapes?
Yeah, I think we should make each other mixtapes. We talked a lot about music in movies in relation to Guardians of the Galaxy. I think it's time we made a mixtape.
Okay, what would be, what vibe? I won't even ask you what artist. What vibe do you feel?
Would I have on the mixtape? I do think, this is actually a great question, because originally in Guardians of the Galaxy 1, uh-huh. The whole shtick here is that this is Peter Quill's mother's Walkman, and this is all the songs that she loved on it, right?
Yep.
And there's like Fleetwood Mac. Mr. Blue Sky's in the second one. There's the Hooked on a Feeling. So I'm guessing what we're talking about is nostalgic. He gets abducted in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
but she's nostalgic.
She's nostalgic for the 60s from the 80s. Jeez, it really is the Quentin Tarantino playlist, isn't it?
Yeah.
What would I look, Fleetwood Mac would definitely be on there. Who am I listening to from that era? I'm pulling up my Spotify as we go right now.
Don't worry about it.
But the vibe, look, my vibe for this, which I think is entirely appropriate for Guardians of the Galaxy, would be romantic ballads from the 70s.
Okay.
Romantic ballads.
Wow.
Romantic ballads from the 70s. What's that song? Go ahead.
I would just send you my karaoke playlist. Oh, it is all over the place.
What's
on
your karaoke playlist?
I just did karaoke for the birthday.
Yeah.
My favorite new one lately is Alice Cooper's Feed My Frankenstein.
Ooh, okay.
Which is a pretty rockin' song. I also have been doing... I have a new playlist, Shahir. I know where this is the only podcast about playlists.
Yeah.
I have a playlist called Good Moods Against All Odds.
Yeah.
And there's a Sam Fight, George Ezra song called Green, Green Grass.
Yeah.
It's real, real, real catchy. And I've been listening to a couple of the tracks on the Cyberpunk soundtrack.
Okay.
Hole in the Sun actually gets me pretty pumped. So I put all those on there for
you. Okay. I've got a very specific one, because I was listening to this over the weekend, and this is Never Been to Me by Charlene, which I was like... for a while, I had this on my playlist rotation as, like, I would love to use this in a movie non-ironically at some point. But then I over the weekend, for some reason, we decided to listen to the Priscilla Queen of the Desert soundtrack.
Sure.
And it was on there. And the reason I love it is in the middle of the song, there's, like, she stops singing and she starts talking to the audience. And she's basically, the song is really about, like, a woman who has never experienced oneness with herself. And
okay.
Like, there's this line in that, like, little monologue where she's like, you see that, you know, that man that you've been fighting with all morning, but you're going to make love to when he comes home tonight, you know, while you're holding the baby, but like, it's just got this this very patriarchal, but kind of sweet monologue about being a woman. And never, you know, anyway, you got to hear the song. If anyone knows it, write us in onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. Let me know if you've rewatched Priscilla Queen of the Desert at any time recently.
And what would your playlist at home, everybody,
yeah,
be?
Yeah, what songs has James Gunn not used that should have been on these tracks?
If you were kidnapped by Ravagers when you were but a child, whatever time period you were the age Peter Quill was when he got taken,
yeah.
What would be on your Walkman, Discman, MP3 player, iPod,
Zoom.
iPhone, Zune. Zunes are so... Zunes were like around for like a year and a half. I love that this obscure technology is now like the heart
I remember almost buying a Zune.
Yeah, I mean, I had like generic MP3 players.
Right, right.
But I never had a Zune.
My favorite one was I had a Discman that had this incredible anti-shock technology in it, which meant I could take it running. And it played MP3s, so I had a disc of like 100 or 200 MP3s.
Oh, yeah.
And that was like my running jams.
Yeah,
and Now I'm old, as you can plainly see. We are definitely old. We had a few emails this week. Much appreciated to everyone who wrote us in at onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. There was one additional email in there. You know who you are. I will email you back directly. Again, thank you to everybody who emailed us in. First one, shall I take this? Ezekiel?
I'll do it.
Go for it.
This is from Ezekiel. They say, hi, Matt and Shahir. I have a feeling Matt has probably seen this, but doubtful Shahir has. Well, okay.
Ooh, yeah,
this
yeah.
is getting spicy. Six String Samurai is a supremely weird post-apocalyptic martial arts film that I saw decades ago and well worth a watch, if only for the strangeness. Hope all is well, Ezekiel.
Whoa, he's got my number there, Ezekiel.
Is he right?
Yeah, 100%. I do not know Six String Samurai. When we got this email, I did watch the trailer. I don't recall it now. But this was in response to our question of, like, what was a birthday movie we could gift each other?
Sure.
So Six String Samurai is on the roster right now. I will try to watch it. Thank you very much for the recommendation, Ezekiel. I love getting recommendations from listeners. There's actually one right now that I think is a movie that is actually playing in cinemas that I do want to see, called The Eighth Mountain.
Okay.
Which was recommended to us. And I actually, every time anyone's, it's not a very seen movie, but everyone who has seen it says it's amazing. So, people out there are smarter than us. Thank you for the recommendations. Have you seen Six String Samurai?
I did forever ago.
You've like seen it? Okay.
I remember the weirdness of it, but anything I could remember would spoil it for you. I mean, it's not much, to be perfectly honest. So I say just we'll watch it together.
All right. Hand in hand. I like it. Coming in from Muhammad. Hope you guys are doing well. Happy birthday to Matt. Hope he enjoyed his day watching Samurai Cop on repeat. Lol.
Okay.
Anyways, I was listening to your excellent discussion on the new Evil Dead movie. And even though I've only seen the 2013 reboot, but have consumed the original Raimi films via GIFs and memes over the years to come to the realization that Evil Dead movies are quintessential Raimi and Campbell. They are the secret ingredient which made those movies what they are. The new reboots could be called anything and it wouldn't change anything. Secondly, while you guys were discussing some other horror movies, I was sad to see no mention of David Pryor's excellent 2020 film, The Empty Man, which in my opinion is one of the best horror movies to come out in the past decade. There's almost a David Fincher-esque level of noir and dread and mood drenched all over it, which makes sense since Pryor was the understudy of Fincher and directed a lot of making of featurettes of David Fincher's films. It is a travesty that the film is a casualty of Fox's merger with Disney, and would love to see an Arrow Video or Shout Factory give it a physical release. All the best. I have heard of The Empty Man. It was streaming on HBO Max for a little bit, or Max, or whatever it's called. I would love to check it out. You've sold me 100%, Muhammad, on the fact that the director was an understudy of David Fincher. I'm there.
Yeah. I have not seen it either. I definitely would. I've been getting more and more disappointed at the ability to find physical releases of things.
Okay. You want the physical releases?
Well, I do. Okay. I've been hunting the data, especially because, you know, lots of times you just can't get movies on streaming, etc. But the one I was looking for, weirdly enough, was Spice World.
Okay. Summit to the Lift, if you had a good time.
Yeah, because you can't stream it. You can get a DVD of it. I was interested to see if there was, like, a Blu-ray or a 4K release, and there is not.
There's not a Blu-ray or 4K release of the biggest band of the 2000s
that
would quintessentially be on the Guardians of the Galaxy playlist if the movie took place, if he was kidnapped in the 2000s?
Not that I can find. Email us in, onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. If you know of where I can purchase that, I will spend cold, hard American doll hairs to get that into my collection.
Okay. Well, I think I found your next Christmas present.
Good luck. I mean, hey, let's do it.
It'll be a crappy disc burn by myself written in Sharpie.
Listen, if it's Blu-ray quality, that high of a bit rate, I'm down, man. I can't, it's hard to watch DVDs across on the newer televisions these days.
One final email. You want to take this one?
This is
reference to something I talked about in relation to Peter Jackson's film Brain Dead, or I think it's called Dead Alive here.
Okay. It is called Dead Alive here. Stephen writes, a good friend of mine was a zombie extra in Peter Jackson's Brain Dead. Because he is a big guy, they put him directly in front of the lawnmower to shield the other extras. That's hilarious. He told me there was so much blood coming out of the lawnmower with so much force, he actually thought he was going to drown at one point. Wow.
Have you, you've seen Dead Alive, I'm presuming.
Yeah.
That is, you know, the thing I think that's amazing about Braindead or Dead Alive, whichever it's called, is I watched that for the first time after I'd seen Lord of the Rings. So I didn't see it prior to Lord of the Rings.
Oh, weird.
I knew about it. It was infamous in New Zealand, the lawnmower scene. In fact, they made commercials. There was an amazing television commercial in New Zealand for the Red Cross. And the Red Cross is basically the equivalent of the Salvation Army that were doing blood drives. And they made a version where they were filming that scene, but there was no blood because the Red Cross needed blood for, you know, like they were trying to get people to come in for a blood drive.
So cool.
That is a clever commercial, right? Like that's a great idea for a commercial. So the film was infamous, but I didn't see it until after Lord of the Rings. And I remember when I saw it, I was thinking, man, I think the qualities that make you think a person could do Lord of the Rings are evident here in this movie. And maybe that's observational bias, but it was because the sort of escalating scale of that movie was so high. You know, like, it just keeps getting wilder and bigger and bigger and bigger to the point you're going, they're not going to do this, are they? They can't possibly do this. And lo and behold, the lawnmower comes out, and you're like, yeah, they're doing this. that is a great revisit. Thank you again, Stephen, for telling us those stories. One last thing I wanted to just chime in. I know we take a little bit of time before we get to the movie, so I'm going to do this very quickly.
Sorry, not sorry.
Well, yeah, you know, I know that I'm supposed to, like, put a time code in the...
You are supposed to, but you not?
I haven't been for a little bit. I apologize.
Listeners.
For that. So if this is an issue, we will try to do that. Maybe enough people write us in and tell us they're not listening to the podcast unless we put time codes in. Will make me do it.
But they wouldn't have gotten to this point.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, you'll never know. They've already dropped off.
They've
now
already
it's
dropped
just the
out.
True believers.
I'm so bad at metrics. but there was an article in The Economist, which I just thought was like, normally I don't try to, you know, with the podcast, the things that we'll talk about in terms of topical issues will come about naturally anyway in relation to the movie. But it hasn't been a while. It has been a while since a headline just grabbed my attention enough to be like, I'm going to make a note of this, and I think we should just quickly chat about this in the podcast. And that is an article that appeared in The Economist called China's New Top Gun Normalizes War with America. And I'm just going to read you the last paragraph from this, but foreign critics call Born to Fly a copy of Top Gun Maverick, a film about American fighter pilots released last year, though not in China. While many of the scenes look similar, the critique is unfair to both films. Top Gun Maverick is wistful and nostalgic and is interested in human frailties as in noisy machines. It depicts a weary superpower and an aging pilot enforcing a multilateral treaty on nuclear non-proliferation, i.e., defending the rules or based order. Alas, Born to Fly, and this is the film that is in question in this article, is closer to the spirit of the first Top Gun. That film from 1986 shows obnoxious young pilots helping a hegemonic America enforce its will without concern for the niceties of international law. Born to Fly is Top Gun with the added nationalist grievance and no sex. If it is a hit in China's cinema, it should alarm the world alike a beaten drum. There wasn't too many comments on this article. It kind of floated past, maybe in The Economist's.
Not too many people go to The Economist for film review.
For film critique. It just jumped out to me like a sore thumb in terms of like this obviously double standard when it comes to Chinese cinema versus American cinema. Not to say, look, I haven't seen the film Born to Fly. It did play in cinemas in America. I watched the trailer of it. It does look a lot like a Top Gun movie. But this idea that it would be clutching at our pearls at the idea that a Chinese film would normalize war after, to be honest, all the bullshit America has done as movies,
man,
for the last, like, you know, 100 years.
And I know, longer than that. And I know that Top Gun Maverick isn't as incendiary as the first Top Gun.
Yeah, it's
as
a treatise as... on peaceful times, surely.
What the fuck is this person smoking, man? Like Top Gun Maverick's wistful and nostalgic and is interested in human frailties as noise machines. It depicts a weary superpower and an aging pilot into enforcing military treaty on nuclear non-proliferation.
It literally
does not name its foe. They are clad in all black.
Yep.
And they are othered to the umpteenth degree. It is military might for the might of the military sake, saying absolutely nothing politically other than America, rah rah. So let's not pretend that Top Gun Maverick is some nuanced take at fighter pilot movies. It's probably the exact same tone, except I don't know if did you see if Born to Fly like calls out America?
I don't know if it does. But and look, again, we're talking about a movie that neither of us have seen. But
I'm just talking about this article. I've seen Top Gun Maverick, and I don't know what this person saw, but it wasn't Top Gun Maverick. It wasn't the same film I saw.
Anyway,
I think The Economist might want to stick to I don't know, The Economy.
Interesting take nonetheless. Look, we've only made it through, 10 minutes of recording time, maybe a little bit more and some change. What is the
Listen,
movie we're discussing?
Well, before we even get to that, let's keep the tangents going. I think...
You know what? Okay, let's
go. I got
a
tangent.
All right, hit me.
So, Shahir, you told me an interesting story this week.
Did I?
You did.
I've actually drawn a blank here is what I told you.
Shahir, for the first time, you win. Out of the two of us, you win. You were recognized on the street for the podcast.
Oh, shit. Yes, I did. Yeah.
You were recognized. I want to say that again to the hundreds of listeners we have. Shahir was recognized on the street for the podcast. Congratulations.
Based on the thumbnail of all things. And again, we use pictures from that we took over three or four years ago. I have long hair and a beard now. But a listener did recognize and stopped and said hi, and we had a conversation, and it was delightful. So
that's so cool.
Yeah, I texted you right away because I thought you would enjoy it. It wasn't actually far from your house as well.
That's so funny.
So you know what you should do?
It,
just walk up and down the street for the next few days, and it could happen again.
Yep, I'll just keep getting coffees over and over and over again.
No,
that's
we
so
appreciate
funny.
That. That is the yep. first time that has ever in the history of this podcast. That is
it's
the first
been a
time
while.
It has ever happened. So it was very very nice.
Sorry. Now we can talk about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Would you like me to start us off with what the Internet Movie Database says about this film?
Sure.
Still reeling from the loss of Gamora, Peter Quill rallies his team to defend the universe and one of their own. A mission that could mean the end of the Guardians, if not successful.
Yeah.
It's a weird ending to that description.
But look, okay. So we've got to address a couple of the elephants in the room here. There's a few of them.
Oh.
Not to harp on animal cruelty, but there is a few elephants in the room that we have to discuss with relation to this film. The first being is that the director of this movie, whom we all are aware of, is one James Gunn, mm-hmm. who was fired from directing this film in 2018 mm-hmm. because of tweets that had been made a decade earlier.
Yep.
Disney had decided that those were unacceptable given the political or cultural climate, and James Gunn was removed from directing Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Now, since that time, a number of things have happened.
Mm-hmm.
The first of which is that he was then courted by DC to helm a Suicide Squad movie, a movie that we reviewed very positively, I think, from both of us, on this podcast, which was released directly to HBO Max, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that was in theaters.
Was it in theaters?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, but it was out. Was it a day and date release?
I think it probably.
I remember seeing it at home. I watched it at home.
Okay.
So it came out very cool. And then he also directed a Peacemaker television series from that point. Mm-hmm. And then has then since been appointed as the head of DC's superhero universe.
He's Kevin Feige over there.
He is the Kevin Feige. So from being fired from the House of the Mouse, he has now become the Kevin Feige of DC. He's like, screw you guys, I'm going to go start my own party. Along with Peter Safran.
And he also directed Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
Was courted back enough to direct Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
Well, almost the whole cast said they wouldn't do it without him. look. We can get into the opinions of this, but the removal of James Gunn in that way, it never sat correct.
Right.
We could talk about that for longer if we wanted to, but the fact that an entire cast of a highly successful franchise was like, nah, what is Disney going to do? They either tank it or they, I mean, I, I don't know. I'm so thankful that this trilogy has ended in the hands of James Gunn.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think it's too far. Like, I guess this is a little shade.
Okay.
But, like, I could very easily see this movie falling into the same category as a Thor Love and Thunder or a Doctor Strange and Multiverse of Madness. There's a lot of plate spinnings, and I feel like those movies drop a bunch,
mm-hmm.
If not for a very daft hand. And, like, you could see the writing on the wall of the screenplay of this one to be like, oh, I could see where this might go wrong.
Right.
But in those places, and there's criticisms to be had about this movie, of course, but in those places, I find that more often than not, the plates are not dropped.
Okay.
James Gunn has an incredible handle on a longer and character-driven story where there are a ton of characters that get both major and minor screen time with arcs and payoffs and a ton of other things.
Right.
That, I don't know, I was very thankful that he was able to see this through.
Right. So there is a sort of a history behind the scenes that led to the way this film has actually come out. Now, another consequence of that is that this was meant to be the first film that came out after Endgame and Infinity War, because Thor ended up with the Guardians of the Galaxy, and there was meant to be a continuing story there. Obviously, also Gamora's storyline from Infinity mm-hmm. War directly ties to this. Unfortunately, because of the kerfuffle with James Gunn and the kind of reshuffling, this film is now coming 6 years after Infinity War, yet still references things that have happened in there. Secondly, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, again, we have talked ad nauseum about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think we've reviewed you've definitely reviewed every film on the show. I have, you know, come in and out of it. We've had our differences about it. You know, go back, listen to the long history there. I think if we were summarizing it, you're appreciative, but also not uncritical of certain storylines. And then I have always maintained that while I like many of the films, I tend to find them a little bit forgettable. Still certainly admire the behemoth that this thing occupies in the cultural landscape that is cinema. But unfortunately, that sort of cultural mainstay of Marvel Cinematic, of the Marvel Cinematic Universe has waned in the last few years. The movies, particularly Thor Love and Thunder, Ant-Man, and the Quantumania, which I didn't see, you reviewed. Mm-hmm. Black Panther, I think Wakanda Forever kind of did okay. Eternals, obviously, which was one of their big new gambits. You know, you could call Eternals the Guardians of the Galaxy gambit of Phase 4 as much as Guardians of the Galaxy itself was a gambit in Phase 2 or whatever it was. Did not fare well either. So the actual, I guess, financial power of these movies has dwindled over time.
But, like, a little. Like, the financial bit of it has never really been a problem.
Well, we are talking, like, a consistent output of number one box office hits that are both critically acclaimed and financially successful enough to generate enough to say that the sequels are given, right?
Sure.
And now we're in a situation where some of those sequels are not necessarily a given.
Well, so yeah, that's very true. I mean, here's the truth of it. I think out of all the Phase 4 stuff, I think Shang-Chi, Black Panther, some of the TV shows, and oddly, Eternals.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are all good, enjoyable movies. I think Eternals is going to weirdly get more appreciated as time goes on, because Eternals took some swings and missed a bunch, but there was still like interest to be had there, in my opinion. I still think about the Eternals more than I definitely think about Doctor Strange or Multiverse of Madness or Love and Thunder. Or Ant-Man. I haven't thought about, I mean, I liked Ant-Man. Don't get me wrong. I liked Ant-Man.
Mm-hmm.
But the last, other than Black Panther, the last three Marvel movies that I saw, I watched
mm-hmm.
and liked fine. It had problems. And then I never thought about it again. And I used to think about these movies all the time.
Right.
And it's because a lot of them, I found, had a strong character-driven emotional core. And it felt a lot like these days, because it could be the pandemic, it could be the amount that people are doing, it could be a combination of everything. It didn't have that. And I'm actually, again, kind of thankful that Guardians 3 didn't have to have Thor in it.
Right.
Like, I like that it's kind of like, yes, it references plot points, namely Gamora passing away in Infinity War, spoilers for Infinity War, and then being brought back through timey-wimey Infinity Gauntlet nonsense, multiversal stuff. But I really liked that that was the only reference. Like, this movie doesn't give a shit about Infinity War or Endgame other than the Gamora connection. It's a story about the Guardians. It's a story about this group of misfits trying to save one of their own. Right. And you get a bunch of their back, that's trying to save Rocket, and then trying to, you get a bunch of Rocket's backstory in it. So this from the get-go, I just fell in love with, because I don't, like, look, are there planet-wide stakes and big explosions and all this other shit in this movie? You bet your sweet Guardian teleporting ass it is. But I will say that those are all backdrops. Like, you, this is character first and forward. And it makes all those big, dumb, stupid digital set pieces actually mean something when you care about the characters that are in those big, dumb digital set pieces. And the stakes are very personal, more so than most other Marvel movies these days, as opposed to, like, the world or the universe is in trouble. Like, this is, for the most part, Rocket or members of the Guardians or a small group of people are in trouble. There's larger connotations and reverberations from the villain and what's going on, but we're focusing on the characters that we're here to see. And I really like that. I wish more films in this genre showed that restraint. I don't know. I dug the hell out of it. What did you think, Shear?
What did I think? It's a really interesting one, because I guess I watch it through the lens of the business more than anything right now, because as it was kind of identified, I'm not that attached to any of the characters, though I certainly have enjoyed the Guardians of the Galaxy. I think the first one was a good time. I thought the second one was, it grew on me quite a bit upon a rewatch as well. And as far as this one goes, I think more than anything, all I thought about was how much of a victory lap this was for James Gunn. You know, like, I mean, the narrative of him being fired from the movie and coming back to close it out, essentially, and before going off into another, you know, to helm the entire overarching narrative of another studio. I just thought how much both he must be thinking about the legacy he has created and will leave behind and is getting to close out. And secondly, how much, you know, an exhilaration it must be to, like, you know, basically tell everyone, hold my beer, know, and like, and in those, so that's really the lens with which I am watching the movie. And then, you know, understandably, I haven't watched Quantumania, but this narrative of Marvel's, you know, like, I think the maybe the phrase that everyone is sort of thinking about is Marvel fatigue. You know, just thinking about it through that lens is like, where does this land in that sort of spectrum? Because that's how I view these films, kind of, you know, on a continuum as opposed to individually. One thing I will say is I think one of the criticisms I've made of these movies is something that I kind of have been thinking about a little bit more recently, which is something that I've thought was a detriment to the actual way these movies are made, which is that they are often setting up other stories.
Yep.
And not necessarily as focused on the individual stories that they're telling. So they don't feel like one-off movies. They feel like part of a grander serialization. One thing I will say that's actually, I thought was a detriment, but I when I watched Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 in particular, I thought, actually, this is one of the key strengths here, is that in many ways, that approach allows them to do things over. And so when movies don't quite land for me, for example, like Guardians of the Galaxy 1, but I thought it was fine, they get to do it over. And we get, and you know, the classic example of this is there were two Thor movies before Taika Waititi came in with Thor Ragnarok and reinvented that. So it was able to build upon what was there before, but it also entirely reinvented because they had two experiences now doing this particular franchise.
Three, then, really, if you count the Avengers.
Yeah, and seeing that character pop up in the Avengers as well, and then reinvent it. And one of the things I was just thinking about as I was watching Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, particularly in the character of Rocket Raccoon, voiced by Bradley Cooper, this was, and again, I won't take credit for this, but this was something I heard on the Big Picture podcast, which is where they talked about the idea that the best special effect that Marvel has kind of generated in a long time is Rocket Raccoon. And we think about the special effects, you know, the conversation around special effects and visual effects for Marvel is highly volatile right now with the firing of Victoria Alonso, but also the, you know, the ongoing conversation about how difficult these movies are to make and how much the VFX houses are being pushed to do these things.
Yeah.
But we tend to think about their visual effects in terms of explosions, battles, the sort of big set pieces, the sort of ginormous moving parts. But one of the ones that they've really perfected here and done beautifully is Rocket Raccoon. And I think it's because over three movies they've had the chance to develop that and give it character and give it identity. And I was like, man, the fact that they've gotten to this stage with this character, and it is such a... It's just, you know, like, we don't think about it as... The amazing thing is we don't think about Rocket Raccoon as a special effect anymore.
Yeah.
But it is an entirely whole cloth generated special effect.
Cosmo and, the dog looks faker than Rocket
than
Raccoon.
Than Rocket Raccoon. Yeah, you're 100% correct. And I think... So, you know, to that point where I guess what I'm getting at is being able to do things over and over and over again has intrinsic benefits as well.
I mean, sure, like even the Hulk in She-Hulk, where yeah. Mark Ruffalo's Hulk, like the only way, like he looked way better visual effects wise. Not that I think She-Hulk looked fine, but the like, it's just funny to like have that just in the pocket because you've done the work
yeah.
before. Like, I know there's tweaks and things, it's not just a repaste.
But it's an ongoing yeah. development, and I guess part of the money funnel of the Marvel Cinematic Universe allows for that development. So I did really appreciate and think about that as I was watching it. I think Gunn, you know, I said before on the Suicide Squad episode that Gunn has a real handle on characters with that happen to be incredibly funny, but also have deeply ingrained trauma that comes out of their humor. I think he's really good at that. That was the most striking part of the Suicide Squad, and it's the most striking part here, which is that in many ways, this is a tale of pre-existing trauma as manifested. You know, like basically the film is playing in two directions. One is yeah. a forward-moving story of the quest to save Rocket, and the other is a flashback story of how Rocket came to be, which I think is really, you know, again, it's evident that Gunn loves these characters and plays them really well, understands the inherent comedy in each of these. I think as well, there's an amazing sort of sense of practicality to this entire film.
Yeah.
You know, like real sets that are weird and strange and colorful and bright and odd and goopy and gloopy and slimy and violent. That is like, again, unique to maybe Gunn's sensibilities and with enough power to be wielded right now, you know, like really works. And I really, really enjoyed. I think it does get a little long in the tooth towards the end and suffers from like a sense that I had at the end of Return of the King, for example, of just trying to do too many things because it is a closing of a chapter, that I found a little bit like, ooh, I think we could get out of here by now. And I, you know, like the sort of overall finale to me was more etched in a victory lap for James Gunn. And I like the victory lap. I like that he can do it. I think he's earned it. Don't get me wrong. It's not like it's an unearned victory lap. But I guess when we're thinking about the finale of the film and the musical sequence that actually accompanies the finale of the film, I saw that more as a victory lap than I did as cathartic for the characters. But, you know, I liked the movie. I had a good time with it. I think it solidifies what Gunn has been good at. And I think more than many, as you kind of pointed to, more than many of the other franchises, it is good serialized storytelling. Like, you know, like I am happy to dip into this film as like a self-contained, encompassing story and not have to do too much work. Although there are quite a few things that this film actually does, but I found even me not knowing like how pieces worked, I had questions about like, is that what Adam Warlock is supposed to be like? He seemed to be a major threat in another film, and he seems like a goofy little dude in this one.
He was never a threat in the film. They just show the cocoon.
But he was like this impending something is coming, right?
I love what they did with Adam Warlock. I'm sorry. I'm going to piss off some comic fans right now. Adam Warlock is dumb. Like, Adam Warlock, there's so many stories, and there are a few good ones, but it's just a bunch of space supermen punching each other when it's Adam Warlock versus Thanos. There's some complicated things going on, but like now that Thanos is hopefully gone forever, there's no point in doing any of the good Adam Warlock stories because in the MCU, it just doesn't make sense. So do something else interesting and weird with him. Turn him into this thing. Like it, I really like the idea of, I mean, essentially, a superpowered child.
Right.
Like, there's... It's funny because, like, in the first sequence in this film, when Rocket initially gets... Adam Warlock is one of the highest genetically created thing from the Sovereign, which are the gold people from Number 2, which the High Evolutionary, played by... Do you know how to pronounce his name? I don't want to get it wrong.
Walter?
No. Chuck Woody...
Sorry. No, I do not know how to pronounce that. I haven't got it in front of me either.
But he plays the High Evolutionary in this film, also steals the goddamn show. We'll get to him in a bit.
Right. There's a third elephant in the room that we haven't mentioned either, but let's continue.
Okay. When Adam Warlock shows up and hurts Rocket when he is being, what's it called? When he is being hunted down, having the High Evolutionary hired Adam Warlock to bring him back, there is a sense of, I feel like, a sense of danger. Like, the Guardians are getting their asses kicked. And in brutal kind of way, like, he snaps Mantis's arm.
Right.
Nebula gets broken all up and her whole thing is she can, like, pop herself back together. Cool. And Rocket takes a near-fatal thing that leaves him in a coma for most of the movie and we deal with his flashbacks. I don't know. I liked that sort of level of tangible. Like, this movie, for as digitally drop painted as it is, as you said, there's sort of a tactileness to it. Mm-hmm. It feels like a lot of sets, or at least a lot of, I don't want to say grime is the right word, but like when someone gets punched or hit or stabbed or shot in this movie, there's weight to it. In a weird way, where a lot of times in these movies there isn't. Like, it feels like in a lot of action cinema these days, that stuff has just sort of lost its punch. And even from the first fight in this movie, I felt like stakes were there and things were getting a little bit down and dirty, which is where I think the Guardians as characters and their stories should kind of operate, which also makes the High Evolutionary a really interesting foil this time around, I think.
I can't say that I was that invested in the story from a sort of tactile point of view in terms of like, I'm really concerned about what's going to happen here. I think I was more invested in like, okay, what is he going to do with this world? I think this is a cool story. For me, where this lands more was almost in a sort of... animal body horror akin to what Guillermo del Toro would do, when Rocket is learning, you know, when we're seeing the process of how Rocket came to be and the friends he made along the way. Mm-hmm. I think to me that, you know, the battle sequences, I think they're again, they're executed very, very, very well. Nathan Fillion is always fun to have in.
Oh yeah.
But I can't say that I was like, invested in the stakes of how the story was going to turn.
I think I really was. Like,
that's great.
I don't want to get into... Well, I mean, what, we're half hour in? We can sort of dally around full spoilers for the movie at this point. I didn't know whether or not, truly, any of the Guardians, minor or major, would die.
Right.
And I think that there's a real strength to James Gunn's writing, storytelling, direction, etc., where I was honestly crying, I feel like, for a fourth of this fucking movie.
Right.
And, like, I got all of the emotional worry and resonance and punch from the film itself without a character dying. But I still felt like I went through, like, the emotional movement of that type of thing.
Right.
Like, he was able to pull that emotion out of me without killing a character. And to me, as a storyteller, even it was funny, I was thinking a lot about, honestly, about D&D, about tabletop role-playing, when I was, like, moving pieces around of a story that's complicated.
Right.
And how you need to save big hits or swings or, like, what could be considered cheap in a story if done wrong for specific moments, etc.
Right.
And this is just such a masterclass. The three James Gunn films in particular for with the Guardians, in making you give a shit enough where if you are invested, and I understand that you and I have different investment levels in this this franchise and its characters. But if you are on board, it rewards you, I think, for that level of being on board. And it doesn't ever make it cheap for you. It makes you go along on a ride with a group of, like, I'll even put it this way, the Avengers.
Right.
They're not, I've never really felt like they were friends. They had a whole party sequence hanging out, and it just felt like colleagues at a work party. Like, they've never right? Whereas the Guardians, by this point, we've watched them become this family. Mm-hmm. And there's something that makes, like, it's interesting. Your point of, like, oh, well, you don't really care. You're not surprised one way or the other. And that's totally fine. But there's an interesting tie, because I think the reason why it works for me, it's like, I know that these are practically Space Muppet special effects characters, right? Like, right. That's, I understand that from a filmmaking perspective. But the story and the script and the acting is so well done, I believe that these characters care about each other more than we're on a team trying to save the world. This movie in particular, they're trying to save their friend.
Right, yeah.
And that has more stakes and weight for me than any amount of sky beams or Thanos's or Infinity Stones. Like,
yeah,
Rocket on the line, being felt by the other characters was huge.
I guess to that end, Endgame, is it Infinity War with the snapping?
Yeah.
I think on a purely visceral, do I care about, you know, whether the characters are going to make it out alive? That was, to me, a bold kind of moment in this. Whereas in this one, like I said, it's not that I wasn't personally invested in whether characters were going to die or live or anything like that. I thought, well, it's a third movie. You know, they're either, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. What I'm also trying to say is that the emotional weight of Rocket's story with the characters that he meets along the way are the things that I actually did care about, that actually emotionally drew me in. Everything else, I'm saying is very well executed, uh-huh. and very well put together, and Gunn is certainly a master at and demonstrates a lot of love for these characters, and they all seem to love what they have been a part of, much like the Hobbits in Lord of the Rings. You know, like,
sure.
they seem to sort of love doing this, and can't fault that. I'm just saying, on a purely story level, I did see this as like a good serialized internal adventure for which there will either be more episodes or we'll turn off at the end of it.
The interesting thing about the snapping, just you bringing it up, is the snapping, while I think was incredibly bold and I loved that it happened at the end of Infinity War, it was such a cool, like, holy fuck moment.
Yeah.
But the truth is, the after you stop thinking about it for 2 seconds, you're like, well, they're all coming back.
Of course.
And that was
the thing about it that was challenging. But again, the Russo, I will say there as well, I think the Russo brothers were playing us like a fiddle and played it perfectly well.
But here, again, why I think I was like, oh shit, this has all the emotional weight tied to me, is I don't know if James Gunn is going to kill off Drax in a moment of heroism and he's dead forever.
Yeah.
Whereas when Drax got, I don't even remember if he got snapped or not. I think he did. I knew that they'd be back.
Right?
Like, it's just, that's kind of how it is.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's why I feel like the stakes here for me were larger, because this is the end of a single, this is a weird thing. The end of a, Ooh. Maybe based on what you just said, there's something also very interesting about that, too, because since this is sort of James Gunn's victory lap and he's going over to play for the other team and he's finishing off a story that he started, I maybe internally was like, oh, he can do whatever the fuck he wants. Like, he can do these characters' stories. A lot of them are ending, or at least they're going to very much change. So, like, yeah. Fuck, Rocket could die. Right. Like there's a lot of ways this could go, and there's so few of the Marvel movies in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years that, like, I can say that about. Like, I kind of knew where every character would end up in every other one.
Actually, to this end, I'm sorry, but, like, I guess Captain America... No, we've got one character that they've definitively killed off, one with which they can still do adventures with, and that's about it, right?
Iron Man is dead.
Yeah.
Who are you thinking about the other one?
Captain America has gone through time, but that does not preclude him from having adventures at some point, right?
I mean, the shitty thing about the multiverse is any of them can come back at any point, a la Gamora. I mean, again, Well, I don't want to break your point. You were going somewhere.
No. My only point there is that, again, what I want to steer it towards is the emotional resonance of understanding Rocket's backstory and where Rocket came from and this, you know, like this little quintet of friends that he made along the way, which carry a lot of weight to him. Which I think is really fascinating. There was a great tweet today. I think James Gunn confirmed that the reason why Rocket is so fascinated with getting people's body parts is that this is because of this backstory. Mm-hmm. So in the first movie, you know, like he was like, let's get that guy's leg. Oh, I didn't really need the leg. What was it like?
Yeah,
you know,
he wants Bucky's arm and he gets it in the Christmas special.
Yeah. Okay. So I didn't see the Christmas special.
spoiler alerts for the Christmas special.
So I think that, and what I think there's been a sort of, cry on the internet about how cruel some of these scenes of vivisection and painful evolution has been. I guess maybe having some sort of filter, knowing that this is a cruelty, you know, an animal cruelty-free production, that I wasn't really feeling that way. But I did think that the sort of level of body horror, I guess design body horror, reminded me of a Guillermo del Toro approach, which is that, like, he, you know, Guillermo del Toro, we know is fascinated with the decrepit and the sort of the sort of fantastical bodies of creatures. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that Gunn approaches this reminded me a lot of that kind of approach, which is that it's done with a lot of love for characters that don't look appealing on screen. You know, that's kind of one of the amazing things that Del Toro is really good at. And I think Gunn demonstrates it here as well. I think, you know, that really works. I think in terms of the movie, it has a one shot towards the back end of it, which, again, I think was executed really beautifully.
The hallway fight?
Yeah, I, you know, probably could have done without the second needle drop of the Beastie Boys, No Rest Till Brooklyn, in a movie. I was like, is this a Chris Pratt thing? Like, when you get Chris Pratt in a movie, you automatically get a Beastie Boys track? Because, you know, that was in Super Mario Brothers as well.
I'll say this.
Yeah.
I think the needle drops in this film were the worst of the three.
I don't think they're bad.
No, but they're not,
there's
like,
just a lot of them. Yeah, there's a lot of, and here's the thing. I was aware that I'm a big Florence and the Machines fan, and I was very aware that Dog Days Are Over was going to be in this movie, because there was a video of her watching the movie and seeing her song on it.
Oh,
and
that's,
you know,
cool.
Florence has a sort of a pretty incredible story in terms of her sobriety and what that song means and how it all works. And so from the first moment that we hear Radiohead's Creep, I kind of knew that Dog Days Are Over is going to be coming at some point. And when it dropped, I sort of, again, like you said, it wasn't transcendent. It was a very good victory lap. But, you know, and then again, you know, No Rest Till Brooklyn, I was like, woo. I was just in a movie theater with Chris Pratt where we did the same thing, and it kind of made me a little weary of it more than anything. You know,
like,
we had this whole conversation in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, how needle drops, you know, like, are it's a fine, it's a very, very fine line.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you know, I think I'm with you, which is that they're not bad. They're not Suicide Squad, the original Suicide Squad, the David Ayer film version of where it just really feels like we haven't thought about this.
We're too used to the absolute craftsmanship of the needle drops, I think, in the other two films. And even, you know, in other gun work where this just felt a little bit odd. I, honestly, the Beastie Boys is the only one that, that bothered me, truly. Like, I was like, we couldn't pull another song to do. Like, no character.
It also doesn't, like... It doesn't make, like...
There's no emotional resonance toward, like the father and son, Cat Stevens, at the end of Guardians 2, huge tearjerker, makes tons of sense, Yondu, Star-Lord, like, the whole thing go, like, I feel like a lot of the, like, the songs have a... Hell, they bake in Brandy. They have Ego, Kurt Russell, talk about the song Brandy, like, and it makes sense. Like, so, like, when Beastie Boys hit, I was like, and it's not like Quill... has a tie at all to the Beastie Boys.
But you see him putting the headphones in to listen to it during what seems like a climactic battle sequence as though this was important to do.
Yeah.
In fact, his entire arc around the final battle is to retrieve that device so that he can contain it with him. But and like, and then he like, and it's the Beastie Boys?
Yeah, I wish there was a scene or something. Because it's funny, because Rocket, in the beginning of this film, has the Zune. And he, like, listens to it and broadcasts it across the Nowhere base.
Yeah.
And I kind of... And it seems like Rocket's been taking the Zune because Peter is super depressed about Gamora and drunk all the time.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe, like, that... I wish it was set up, like... Again, I don't need this because what I'm going to describe sounds stupid and pedantic, but like some sort of way where like Peter knew what tracks Rocket was listening to the most or something.
Right.
And like that was something that drove him in the final sort of thing to like keep it moving or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you know, something like that would have been really nice. It's not necessary. It's just, it's, I was so confused about the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, it just yeah, I think you're right, which is that they're, what it is they're not as strong choices as they were before. But, you know, again, it's not like Gunn's bad at this.
No.
Like, it's not like, you know, there's poor choices being made here.
What was the third elephant?
The third elephant is that something that I have not quite been tracking because I haven't seen Quantumania and I haven't seen Loki, but certainly... Kang is a major part of how the MCU was going to be shaping the movement towards Phase 4 and 5. You know, like even I think Destin Crichton was being brought in to direct the Avengers. The next Avengers movie is going to be called the Kang Dynasty, or
Secret Invasion. Before I forget what it is.
Yeah, but they're leading towards major. You know, Kang, I think, had been a central focus of how they were going to reorganize the MCU, based not only on, you know, trying to find both a replacement for Thanos, but also Jonathan Majors, you know, star power had been rising of late, not least of which because of Creed 3, other performances that he'd been in as well. So, you know, he was a major player in the field, and I didn't see Quantumania, but I hear he's great in it.
He's excellent.
Unfortunately, without reading into the situation one way or the other, just looking at this from a business point of view, Majors is obviously in a major critical moment in his career, not least of which may be because of an assault charge that has been leveled at him. I believe
there's a few of them at this point.
And to really make it clear, I don't know a lot about the details of this, so if I'm speaking out of turn in any of this, I apologize and don't mean to infer one way or the other. I have no, you know, dog in that fight. My only point here is to look at this from how that had been clearly one of the guiding principles of how the MCU was going to reorganize itself and now is not, having to rethink that.
I think Kang, to be perfectly honest, was never going to be a part of this movie at this junction.
Well, he may not have been of this movie, but as much as Thanos was the big bad that was
threaded
through...
Oh, no, I know they're doing that setup. But again, I go back to, this is why I like this movie. Like, you've even said this is kind of like the victory lap. It's a safe space to be unsafe because it's the end of a thing, even though it's a small part of a larger thing that's going to keep moving.
Right.
And, like, I loved there was no multiverse mention. I love that Thanos or that Thanos or Kang or whatever like had no pull. Like I, right. And because of that, transitioning back to the High Evolutionary. Pretty C-tier, in my opinion, villain in the comic books. I've never been terribly interested in this character.
Right.
This is the first... I think the High Evolutionary is the best overall emotional... I've never hated a Marvel villain before. Like, huh. Actively hated. I had a visceral emotional hatred, but not for the, you know, obviously the performance. The performance is excellent.
Yeah.
It's nuanced. You know what this character wants. You see the quirks. You see the cruelty. You see all of this stuff. And there's danger. There's uncertainty. Like, the level of just fear-inducing for these characters, again, for me. Like, Thanos is a titan. He killed half the fucking universe. Like there's like that's of course a very scary proposition, and you understand his power,
right?
But like, and he had conviction in his, but like his whole thing was like resource management. Like there's a weird lizard part of your brain that's like, well, Thanos could be right in X, Y, and Z, like whatever, blah blah blah. This is a character, the High Evolutionary, where you're like, fuck this guy. Huh. And it's such an interesting, like, I can't, sure, you can disagree with all the villains and what they're trying to do, because intrinsically a lot of the stuff is bad.
Right.
But, like, I've never with any Marvel villain thought, like, been actively, like, angry and upset, being like, this fucker needs to go. Like, huh. Like, and there's something, you know, it could be, you know, what he did to all the animals and the abuse or whatever, but it's also, like, the unhinged eugenics bullshit. Mm. Like, that, like, there's so many different pieces in the soup of what this character of the High Evolutionary is. I was just like, evil corpo, check. Eugenics piece of shit, check. Tortures animals, check. Inferiority complex, check. Like, I was just like, fuck this guy. And it was so, I don't want to say it's fun to hate him, but a film and its plot, especially something like this, is a puzzle. And that piece fits so nicely into making me care about everything that was going on. And I can't think of another Marvel villain that actually has carried that amount of full-blown emotional weight for me.
Right. Okay. I mean, I'm glad that that was the case for you. I was not quite as invested in, you know, I think the thing maybe is that I, for example, in Wakanda Forever, I think mm-hmm. Namor as a character yep. was one that I was genuinely interested in, because I actually really thought that Namor is the central character in his story.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And he is the hero of his story. So I found that the sort of conflict between what is going on in Wakanda and Shuri against Namor was sort of rich material that I was really interested in. I can appreciate that you had a visceral reaction to, like, this is just a bad guy. Or this is a bad guy who needs to go.
He is a bad guy that actually caused me to hate him. Like Namor, right. I agree with you entirely with what you said.
Yeah.
He's interesting because he is the main character in his own story. And yeah. you can, in some different ways, based on the history that you know what happened to him, understand where he's coming from. That is a relatable villain.
Yeah.
And also one that feels real.
Yeah, that to me is, I guess, maybe... for me was more interesting, whereas with the High Evolutionary, there was a kind of, I guess for me, a little bit of a mustache twirly kind of quality to it. Where I was like, oh yeah, of course he's going to kill all these people because he doesn't give a shit. And like, yeah, that's what he does. You know, like I was like, eh, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't
the care. Way they set him up, I think that what gets him out of mustache twirly town for me
yeah.
is they set him up as a true believer of whatever this nightmare thing is that he's doing. He thinks, and he's built a whole corporation and people around him, that he is basically, he's turned himself into a god.
Right. But that's not unlike Ego, for example, in that story, right? I mean, obviously there's different mechanics to it, but it's they're dealing with, you know, and Thanos is a god in his world as well. So I you know, like, again, I'm
trying to think why Ego didn't hit the same note for me. Is it just
I actually
Kurt
thought
Russell's
Ego, again, I guess maybe the other
eyes,
thing, right? Is I thought Ego was more interesting because Ego is essentially a surrogate for Pratt's father.
He is Pratt's father.
Yeah, exactly.
He is Star-Lord's father.
Is he actually his father? He is actually his father. Yeah. So, so you know,
he's
I guess I found
father
that
too, technically.
Yeah. So I guess I found that more interesting. Whereas I, you know, like I'm not
It's relatability.
Yeah.
Like it's so, and this might be why the High Evolutionary is interesting to me and has such an emotional pull.
Right.
Normally, when a villain is not relatable.
Right.
I hate him in a, like, boo, bad guy, boo. Like, right. Not like in an, I don't give a shit. Like, I don't truly care.
Yeah.
But because of the interesting mix of characters and because what he did to Rocket and because of his specific ideology and his brand of evil.
Right.
It all mixed together and it knocked it out of Mustache Twirl Town for me. It was, he is a legit character with goals and shitty dreams, and he needs to be fucking put down. And
shitty dreams.
I haven't had that in a while.
Right.
And so I, like, even Ego, like, Ego had a weird charm to him.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah.
All different kinds
maybe
of villains.
I think that's interesting. You know,
it isn't. No, it's 1,000% interesting. Yeah. I haven't had a believable, emotionally visceral response of hatred to a fucking Marvel villain before.
Right.
And it's just nice. It's a nice, we've talked about it too long. Yeah. I think the performance was great. I think what they did with the character was great. I'll sort of say this, just to wrap up my thoughts. I know we're going a little long.
Sorry.
This movie reminded me, again, how much I can like Chris Pratt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there has been in the years since we've done Guardians of the Galaxy as well, there's been a waning of the Chris Pratt love affair that the public has had, right?
Yeah, there's something that Gunn knows how to do with Star-Lord, and I think what it is Star-Lord's strength, especially as he's grown, the joke is that he's like a man-child.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, even though he has his own demons he's dealing with, all of his great moves come from people underestimating him and thinking he's just a man-child, and him playing into just being a man-child and then tricking people and being successful and actually heroic.
Right.
And that's an interesting, like, weird, good take on it. I also think James Gunn can just direct that type of character well. Right. I never really liked Star-Lord granted, he makes dumb decisions, but he kind of has to for the plot in Infinity War and Endgame. Like, when the Russos direct Star-Lord, it feels different. I'm no full slight to the Russos at all, but like it feels like Gunn and Chris Pratt together get this character and can make that type of very difficult character sing it, when normally that character just comes off as annoying.
It's sort of akin to the way Taika and Chris Hemsworth,
sure,
found a sort of avenue for Thor.
Yeah.
That made sense. Yeah, I agree with that. I'm, you know, this thing with Chris Pratt's waning public personality, I'm always curious by, like, I just think there's like an ebb and flow to the way these things happen, and you know, like he's out of flavor now. I'm sure he'll come back in flavor at some point or whatever.
But like, there was a blandness. I'm not even talking about like, do I like him as, I mean, I don't know him as a person, but like in performances, like the Tomorrow War, all the Jurassic Worlds.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just like, I don't, nothing here is interesting.
Well, I guess to that end, unlike Thor, which really does anchor itself around Chris Hemsworth as the leading man, the hero, even making fun of that idea.
Yep.
I guess there's something interesting in the fact that Guardians has realized over time that he is not the central player here, that the interplay between the characters is what makes this work. And in fact, for me, Drax has the most interesting and compelling arc of the movie, you know, which is that I think the line that I think is quietly devastating in this movie is that, you know, you are meant to be a father.
You're not meant to be a destroyer. You're meant to be a dad.
You're meant to be a dad. And that's, you know, like Drax's whole story is that his daughter has died in the first movie. Ronan killed his daughter. And so, you know, like the idea that he gets to be a dad, it plays into a narrative arc for that character really nicely. And secondly, for Dave Bautista, who's like now also in that sort of upward swing mm-hmm. of public, you know, his public persona, it actually just plays really nicely for that actor as well. So I think it's a really nice interplay.
Every one of the characters. Oh, sorry.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say the Zoe Saldana Gamora character and the sort of interrelationship between her and Star-Lord, I thought was a little. It felt a little one note to me. Like it kind of felt like they were. It was the same beat being repeated over and over and over again.
I think that's important.
Right.
I think this movie does a really good job at, again, in a lesser storyteller's hands, I think this could have been a complete, like, what I never fucking wanted was Quill and Gamora to get together in this movie. Like,
I agree with that. I guess what I'm saying is that the note was kind of,
But I liked that the note was he kept trying and was fucking confused and heartbroken and shattered as a human being. And she was like, what the fuck? I am not this person. And like that, like it was hard to have that wall keep getting hit. And I do see what you're saying of like the one note of it. Yeah. But I really like where they ended it. Like it felt like a healthy ending
to a very complicated
situation. Like,
you know what I think it, I was sort of, I guess maybe struck by and just was like sort of wondering a little bit more was that, why the two sisters narrative wasn't more
I think
of a deal.
I you know, think like it, because it, they realized, hey, they deal with that a shit ton in two.
Right.
I think Nebula a couple times says, even references this, but like Nebula understands that that's not the sister she grew up with. And but Nebula's kind of cold anyway. Yeah. Like, So I think that's kind of why Peter is, again, acting childish or just not, like, I mean, that's a fucking insane prop. I mean, I know we're talking about space raccoons and shit, but, like, the proposition
but
of a loved one.
The space raccoon works.
Yeah.
Here's one thing. I don't know if we talked about it in any way, but Bradley Cooper is the MVP.
Yeah.
You know, like,
he didn't
really
do any press.
He didn't do any, you know, like, he comes in, he does, I think Bradley Cooper, who's such a, you know, like in many ways a bigger movie star than Chris Pratt, mm-hmm. I get the sense he probably enjoys the kind of anonymity he gets from just doing the voice. And he really, like in all three of these movies, I think he's the MVP. Like he really like brings it. And again, to that point, which is that the key VFX here that we don't even think about as a VFX anymore, as a visual effect anymore, is Rocket Raccoon. Like, he is, you know, like, that is the key visual effect. When the two, you know, like, the celestial head and the
Nowhere in the High Evolutionary ship.
Yeah, High Evolutionary's cube ship are crashing into each other. It's par for the course in this kind of thing. I'm not that, you know, like, enamored by it, but Rocket Raccoon as a character unto himself and his eyes and the animals and things around it, I think that's the beauty. That's the really, like, extraordinarily, you know, that's the jaw-dropping stuff that is actually worth the price of admission. And I really, really like, you know, so I'm making that point again, which is that by the third time around when they've gotten so good at this, that's where I sort of start seeing the value and the repetition and the serialization of how this is going. I certainly had a good time with it. I certainly applauded at Gunn having a victory lap on this because that was such a roller coaster ride to get here. And you know, I think I'm excited for, you know, I it's weird. I don't care about DC versus Marvel. I don't give a shit. I'm just excited that, you know, like, I think in the same way when Taika jumped into Thor, it was like, oh, this filmmaker who I've associated with these kinds of small films has like a unique voice in this huge machinery. And I think Gunn is kind of proving also to have, you know, in many ways usurping that kind of quality in terms of being the star player in the director lineup, of having like a unique voice in the giant machinery here. And I, you know, like the fact that he's jumping over to super, you know, doing a Superman movie, I'm like, okay, cool. I, you know, there couldn't be another character I have less interest in.
Yep.
That I'm like, yes, whatever this person wants to do with that character, I'm here for, and I'm willing to see that.
He made Peacemaker interesting. He made me care about Peacemaker.
Yeah,
like I think he could do Superman.
I'm here for it. So I applauded the victory lap of it all. We get into the sort of rankings because the Marvel Cinematic Universe exists on the spectrum. We get into this ranking thing. Do I even know? Does it go 3, 2, 1? I don't know. Maybe something like that.
But
it doesn't really matter.
No. I was so thankful to walk out of a Marvel movie and just be like, what a fucking great time I just had.
Right.
Like, what a gamut of emotions I actually felt at a giant blockbuster tentpole thing from this thing that I used to care so much about.
Right.
And, like, I really hope, and again, everything has so many fucking moving parts. Like, I hope that the next whatever the hell movies down the line, like, I hope that they can see the things in this movie that really work and that audiences are resonating with versus the stuff that, say, didn't work in Multiverse or Love and Thunder. Like,
I want to say to that is I think everyone's acutely aware of what works and what doesn't work and when a movie lands and when it doesn't land and when they think, you know, this doesn't.
Yeah.
It's just that this is a massive fucking train. You know, like, this is a
massive machine.
And it's like, sometimes it goes, you know, and also, you know, like Pixar is experiencing right now, they had a solid 15-year run of, like, just bangers.
This is not roles being reversed and you defending the MCU and me attacking it. I'm saying, there are tangible, like, production and story elements that I feel like have been lacking. And for whatever reasons, could be pandemic, could be shuffling, could be a million different reasons. Could be too much shit coming out.
Right.
And I just hope that they see the success and take away some things that can make some other things more successful.
To maybe summarize a thesis about why Gunn works well here... Mm. Is that I think, in at least within the industry, the Marvel Cinematic Universe has encompassed a space. We've seen it actually work in direct correlation with, like, finding young indie filmmakers that have made one film and then bringing them onto this, like, massive production and seeing if they can, you know, sink or swim. And the criticism that have been leveled at the Marvel Cinematic Universe in terms of their production engine has been that, you know, that it is a television show as opposed to individual movies. So these directors' personalities, some manage to float and, you know, a lot of them manage to sink. And I think from an overall sort of narrative of, like, what it means to direct a Marvel movie, and again, this is, you know, speculation based upon just evidence we've seen in the actual business of it all, is that we think that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is, like, a good stepping stone. You know, like, it's a good thing to get offered a Marvel movie. It's a good thing to, like, you can do two Marvel movies and then you kind of set up for whatever it is you want to do. Like, you know, Taika's got that, you know, next goal wins coming out after Thor, Love and Thunder, which made a lot of money but wasn't critically, you know, on par with anything else he had done. So I think my thesis about Gunn is that Gunn is a filmmaker who came up through the indies, but this is what he was always heading towards.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is, I don't think there's a going back to little, you know, like, to doing another super, for example. I think this is what he wanted to do. This is what he likes to do. He loves these kinds of movies and he loves these characters. And the thesis there is that that's what it requires, not the sort of pluckish upstart that is coming in to do one or two and then get out. You know, like, it requires someone who's willing to basically, we are not going to see anything but franchise film from James Gunn, I don't think, for the rest of his career.
I bet you he'll do one or two tiny things, but not for a while. I mean, right now he's crazy busy for at least 10 years.
Like, at least 10 to 15 years. And, like, with a, you know, what is, you know, I whereas Taika is going to do Next Goal Wins, or he's already done it, and I think that's kind of where his heart is a little bit.
You know, totally.
Yeah. And so that's a thesis I'm sort of just sort of speculating on in terms of like why this works.
Fair.
You know, but also, but it's a massive machine.
Yeah. Also, I feel like we didn't talk about Mantis at all. Palm
Clementine. Yeah.
Yeah, is amazing. And I love seeing a support character at the end of a story being like, I need to go do my own thing now. Yeah. Like, I've been supporting everyone my entire life. I need to go do something else that's super powerful. Like, every character has, like, a cool, powerful change based on all of the things that happened before them.
Yeah.
Nebula becoming sort of a, like, a town leader, in a way, is so, like, therapeutic. And, like, Groot, obviously, is just Groot. Like, I don't know.
Well, he's had a whole arc.
Yeah.
Is Groot male or female, by the way? Does it matter?
I don't think that actually...
There is no correlation to that.
I am Groot.
Yeah. We are.
I don't know. I feel like everyone in this movie gets a chance to shine, even down to fucking Kraglin and Cosmo. Like, there's just... I don't know. It's just... I love this movie.
Look, I didn't see the Christmas special, but I liked Cosmo's... it's my favorite part of Family Guy is when Brian acts like a dog. You know, like when Brian is like talking very erudite and then is a dog, like scratches, you know, like does things. I think it's always a fun gag. Can you explain to me, is there any meaning to the post-credit sequence with Quill and his grandfather talking about the lawnmower?
No, I think it's
I guess this is something I don't know.
If maybe there is, I don't know. I think it was weird. Too many people were talking in my theater, so I might have missed a line or two.
Right.
I thought it was just to show like how like low key and low stakes his life was now.
Right.
And like that was sort of a good partial ending. I know it said the famous Star-Lord will be back or whatever, the legendary Star-Lord. Star-Lord.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if I don't care if he shows up again,
Okay, so that's actually an important question.
Yeah.
Do we want to see more Guardians of the Galaxy movie? And I'm like, I think at this point it's like if there's a compelling reason to make it, but if this is it, I'm fine with this.
Yeah, here's the truth. The Guardians team at the end with Rocket and Warlock and all that and Kraglin, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really want to see that.
Yeah.
But if, like, and he won't have time to do this, but if James Gunn came back and said, I have a fucking great idea for that next Guardians team, I'd be like, okay. Like,
it's got to be a Toy Story 4 type scenario.
I guess. Right? Yeah. Like, I like the concept of Star-Lord always being out there and maybe tapping him for like a part in another Marvel movie, but I don't think I need a Star-Lord story. Like I think we've done all the Star-Lord stories that I'm interested in.
Right.
So I don't know. Anyway, I love this movie. I'm so happy it exists. I needed a Marvel win, a bigger one for me. I don't know. Ant-Man and Thor and Strange rubbed me the wrong way.
I'm glad. I'm glad.
Yeah. This has been the only podcast about the film Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Shahir, when you are not carving your way into an organically grown space station, where can folks find you?
You can find me growing roots. Is that what Groot does?
Yeah,
on
sure.
My website, www.shahirdaud.com. That's SHAHIRDAUD.com. Matt, when you are donning the helmet and leather jacket to fly through space, only to have forgotten your oxygen mask, where can people find you?
You can find me scrambling for my own Zune over at my website, matthewcarroll.com, for my life and works. Also, Skeletron, the number 4, P-R-E-Z on Instagram, or PSN on Twitter, or and PSN. Wow, I just fucked that whole thing up. Don't worry about it. You know where to find me. Also, please check out the good works we're doing over at Extra Credits. We're in the middle of our Napoleon in Egypt series. I believe by the time this airs, 4 of 5 parts will be out. Also, we just did an Extra Mythology. I think it dropped today, actually, the day we're recording this, on the last Wednesday, on Orpheus. And his journey into hell to...
Did he look back?
Spoiler alert, he looks back.
He sure did.
And then we got a cool... coming up in a couple days after this launches, we have a great episode on the price of change on the Extra Credits Gaming side, which is basically about like why we as creators or people that use tool sets in creative mediums, really any medium, like stick with certain ways of doing things because there's a cost to, like, there's that old anecdote, which is not entirely true, about the QWERTY keyboard.
Yep. Yep.
Right. About typewriters getting jammed because people write so they slow down. That's not exactly true, but like there are more efficient ways to type than QWERTY layouts for keyboards, but everyone's learned it. So what's the cultural cost of stopping and teaching every, like how much is like, yes, there is a better way to do it. No one will ever spend the time. So we talk about that sort of concept And like when making changes to a video game, especially like a live service game or something, like just knowing how to interact with that, knowing how best to address those costs. And it's a fascinating look at sort of production in a way. Yeah. So I liked that.
You know what's really interesting? Just before we go, for about a week and a half solid, there was an image from a movie that I had in my head that I couldn't place. I was like, I remember this image. I remember the way this image made me feel, but I was struggling to remember what movie it was. And then you mentioned the Orpheus story just then, and it all clicked in my head. The image I was remembering was from Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And it was an image, there was sort of a ghostly image where it sort of resembled what Orpheus may have been looking back at, but I believe it was the house. And honestly, for a week solid, I had this in my head, and I was trying to remember what it was until you just said that. And
look
now
at
it's,
that.
And now it's all clicked. Because Orpheus was a major part of Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
I believe, though, Adele Hanel has retired from filmmaking. That was movie news.
Celine Sciamma was the director. I know
no,
Adele,
the actress. One of the actors.
Yeah, the actress may have. And she and Celine Sciamma may have been. I may be misremembering which one is which, but.
It was basically in protest of calling out the general complacency of the French film industry with sexual aggression.
She walked out during a sort of a something that was being acclaimed for Roman Polanski.
Oh, okay.
If I recall correctly, which is fair. There's a lot going on also
in the filming. I feel like we haven't really talked much about the writer's strike, but I'm standing with all those folks out there fighting for their
union. As you can tell, we don't. There's no writers on this show.
Nope.
But we definitely stand in solidarity.
Yeah. Hopefully the dominoes. I mean, we could actually be interesting to do a whole episode on just sort of something like that at some point, but. Hopefully everyone's out there doing well, and we wish you well. And also, if you're trying to give picketers, food and stuff, there's been many tweets about like they have enough pizza and donuts, and like if you do want to donate stuff, it's water, granola, healthy snacks, that sort of thing. So remember
writers
that if you're
being like bemoaning the craft services table.
Well, it's just like there's obviously it's a lovely kindness, but like it's I can totally see that. So anyway,
and I know we've gone over one last tangent, which is that people have written in to on last week's episode. We talked about Polite Society and how difficult it was for my wife to get to it. People actually wrote in screening times. They were like, "Hey, it's playing at this theater."
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah, and I think it's actually it is available in a couple more theaters. Though again, only one session a night will be at the kind of like acceptable time for a mother to go to.
Yeah.
But I can happily report that my wife is going to go to see Polite Society this Saturday. By the time this episode comes out, she would have already seen
it yesterday.
And she is going with a group of friends,
yay,
all mothers. They at the time of booking this the seats, they are the only people in the theater. It is a theater that serves food, and I couldn't be more excited for them.
Hell yeah!
You know that they're going to go and they're going to have a great time at this movie.
I'm glad. That's very, very fun.
So, thanks to everyone who wrote in and gave us some tips on that one.
Yeah, thank you. Next week, there'll be a movie.
There will be. I don't know what it is.
We don't know yet. It'll be fine.
Let's do Polite Society again. I don't know.
Yeah, sure. All right, everybody. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.